Chapter 60, Saul Makes a Terrible Mistake. After the assembly at Gilgal, Saul disbanded the army that had at his call arisen to overthrow the Ammonites. Here was a serious error. His army was filled with hope and courage by the recent victory, and had he proceeded at once against other enemies of Israel, a telling blow might have been struck for the liberties of the nation. Meanwhile, the Philistines were active. They had still retained some hill fortresses in the land of Israel, and now they established themselves in the very heart of the country. During the long period of their oppressive rule, the Philistines had endeavored to strengthen their power by forbidding the Israelites to practice the trade of smiths, lest they make weapons of war. The Hebrews still resorted to the Philistine garrisons for such work as needed to be done. Controlled by the abject spirit induced by long oppression, the men of Israel had to a great extent neglected to provide themselves with weapons of war. Bows and slings the Israelites could obtain, but none among them except Saul and his son Jonathan possessed a spear or sword. Not until the second year of Saul's reign was an attempt made to subdue the Philistines. The first blow was struck by Jonathan, who overcame their garrison at Geba. The Philistines, exasperated, made ready for a speedy attack upon Israel. Saul proclaimed war by the trumpet, calling all men of war, including the tribes across the Jordan, to assemble at Gilgal. The Philistines had gathered an immense force at Michmash, 30,000 chariots, and 6,000 horsemen, and the people as the sandwiches on the seashore in multitude. Saul and his army at Gilgal were appalled at thought of the mighty forces they would have to encounter in battle. Many were so terrified that they dared not come to the encounter. Others hid in caves and amid rocks in that region. As the time drew near, desertions rapidly increased, and those who did not withdraw were filled with terror. When Saul was anointed king, he had received from Samuel explicit directions concerning the course to be pursued at his time. "Thou shalt go down before me to Gilgal," said the prophet, "and, behold, I will come down unto thee, to offer burnt offerings, and to sacrifice sacrifices of peace offerings. 7 days shalt thou tarry, till I come to thee, and show thee what thou shalt do." Discouraged by circumstance, day after day Saul tarried, but without encouraging the people and inspiring confidence in God. Before the time appointed by the prophet had fully expired, he allowed himself to be discouraged by the trying circumstances that surrounded him. Instead of seeking to prepare the people for the service that Samuel was coming to perform, he indulged in unbelief. The work of seeking God by sacrifice was a most solemn work. God required that his people search their hearts and repent of their sins, that the offering be made with acceptance, and his blessing attend their efforts to conquer the enemy. But Saul had grown restless, and the people, instead of trusting in God for help, were looking to the king to lead and direct them. Yet the Lord still cared for them and did not give them up to disaster. He brought them into close places that they might be convicted of the folly of depending on man and that they might turn to him as their only help. The time for proving Saul had come. Would he depend on God and patiently wait according to his command as one whom God could trust in trying places as the ruler of his people? Or would he be vacillating and unworthy of the sacred responsibility that had devolved upon him? Would the king listen to the ruler of all kings? Would he turn the attention of his faint-hearted soldiers to the one in whom is everlasting strength and deliverance? With growing impatience he awaited the arrival of Samuel and attributed the distress and desertion of his army to the absence of the prophet. The appointed time came, but the man of God did not appear. God's providence had detained his servant. Feeling that something must be done to calm the people, Saul determined to summon an assembly and by sacrifice entreat divine aid. God had directed that only those consecrated to the office should present sacrifices before him. But Saul commanded, "Bring hither a burnt offering," and he approached the altar and offered sacrifice. Saul's presumption. And it came to pass, that as soon as he had made an end of offering the burnt offering, behold, Samuel came. Samuel saw at once that Saul had gone contrary to the express directions that had been given him. If Saul had fulfilled the conditions upon which divine help was promised, the Lord would have wrought a marvelous deliverance for Israel. But Saul was so well satisfied with himself that he went out to meet the prophet as one who should be commended rather than disapproved. To Samuel's inquiry, "What hast thou done?" Saul offered excuses for his presumptuous act. "I saw that the people were scattered from me, and that thou camest not within the days appointed, and that the Philistines gathered themselves together at Michmash. Therefore said I, the Philistines will come down now upon me to Gilgal, and I have not made supplication unto the Lord. I forced myself therefore, and offered a burnt offering." And Samuel said to Saul, "Thou hast done foolishly. Thou hast not kept the commandment of the Lord thy God, which he commanded thee, for now would the Lord have established thy kingdom upon Israel forever. But now thy kingdom shall not continue. The Lord hath sought him a man after his own heart, and the Lord hath commanded him to be captain over his people." And Samuel arose, and gat him up from Gilgal unto Gibeah of Benjamin. Either Israel must cease to be the people of God, or the monarchy and the nation must be governed by divine power. In Israel no monarchy could prosper that did not in all things acknowledge the supreme authority of God. In this time of trial, Saul's failure proved him unfit to be the vicegerent of God to his people. He would mislead Israel. His will, rather than the will of God, would be the controlling power. Since he had failed, the purpose of God must be accomplished by another. The government of Israel must be committed to one who would rule according to the will of heaven. The reason for Saul's sad failure. Saul was in disfavor with God and yet unwilling to humble his heart in penitence. He was not ignorant of Israel's defeat when the Ark of God was brought into the camp by Hophni and Phinehas, and yet, knowing all this, he determined to send for the sacred chest and its attendant priest. By this means he hoped to reassemble his scattered army and give battle to the Philistines. He would dispense with Samuel's presence and free himself from the prophet's unwelcome criticisms and reproofs. The Holy Spirit had been granted to Saul to enlighten his understanding and soften his heart. And yet how great was his perversity! That impetuous spirit, not early trained to submission, was ever ready to rebel against divine authority. Men cannot for years pervert the powers God has given them, and then, when they choose to change, find these powers fresh and free for an opposite course. Saul's efforts to arouse the people proved unavailing. His force reduced to 600 men, he retired to the fortress at Geba on the south side of a deep, rugged gorge a few miles north of Jerusalem. On the north side of the valley, at Michmash, the Philistine force lay encamped, while troops went out in different directions to ravage the country. Jonathan, the king's son, is honored. God had permitted a crisis that he might rebuke Saul and teach his people a lesson of humility and faith. Because of Saul's sin in his presumptuous offering, the Lord would not give him the honor of vanquishing the Philistines. Jonathan, the king's son, who feared the Lord, was chosen. Moved by a divine impulse, he proposed to his armor-bearer that they make a secret attack upon the enemy's camp. "It may be," he urged, "that the Lord will work for us, for there is no restraint to the Lord to save by many or by few." The armor-bearer, also a man of faith and prayer, encouraged the design. Together they withdrew from the camp secretly, lest their purpose be opposed. With earnest prayer to the guide of their fathers, they agreed upon a sign by which they might determine how to proceed. Passing down into the gorge separating the two armies, they silently threaded their way under the cliff, partially concealed by the ridges of the valley. Approaching the fortress, they were revealed to their enemies, who said tauntingly, "Behold, the Hebrews come forth out of the holes where they had hid themselves. Come up to us, and we will show you a thing, meaning that they would punish the two Israelites for their daring. This challenge was the token that Jonathan and his companion had agreed to accept as evidence that the Lord would prosper their undertaking. Choosing a secret and difficult path, the warriors made their way to a cliff that had been deemed inaccessible and was not strongly guarded. Thus they penetrated the enemy's camp and slew the sentinels, who, overcome with surprise and fear, offered no resistance. Angels of heaven shielded Jonathan and his attendant, angels fought by their side, and the Philistines fell before them. The earth trembled as though a great multitude with horsemen and chariots were approaching. Jonathan recognized the tokens of divine aid, and even the Philistines knew that God was working for the deliverance of Israel. Great fear seized the host. In the confusion, the Philistines began to slay one another. Soon the noise of the battle was heard in the camp of Israel. The king's sentinels reported great confusion among the Philistines and that their numbers were decreasing. Seeing that the Philistines were meeting with a repulse, Saul led his army to join the assault. The Hebrews who had deserted to the enemy now turned against them. Great numbers also came out of their hiding places. As the Philistines fled, Saul's army committed terrible havoc upon the fugitives. Again, Saul is foolish. Determined to make the most of his advantage, the king rashly forbade his soldiers to partake of food for the entire day. "Cursed be the man that eateth any food until evening, that I may be avenged on mine enemies." The victory had already been gained without Saul's knowledge or cooperation, but he hoped to distinguish himself by the utter destruction of the vanquished army. The command to refrain from food showed the king to be indifferent to the needs of his people when these conflicted with his desire for self-exaltation. He declared his object to be, "Not that the Lord may be avenged on his enemies, but that I may be avenged on mine enemies." The people had been engaged in warfare all day and were faint for want of food, and as soon as the hours of restriction were over, they devoured flesh with the blood, thus violating the law that forbade the eating of blood. During the day's battle, Jonathan, who had not heard of the king's command, unwittingly offended by eating a little honey as he passed through a wood. Saul had declared that violation of his edicts should be punished with death, and though Jonathan had not been guilty of a willful sin, and though God had wrought deliverance through him, the king declared that the sentence must be executed. "God do so, and more also," was his terrible sentence, "thou shalt surely die, Jonathan." Jonathan's life is saved. Saul could not claim the honor of the victory, but he hoped to be honored for his zeal in maintaining the sacredness of his oath. The people refused to allow the sentence to be executed. Braving the anger of the king, they declared, "Shall Jonathan die, who hath wrought this great salvation in Israel? God forbid, as the Lord liveth, there shall not one hair of his head fall to the ground, for he hath wrought with God this day." Jonathan's deliverance was a severe reproof to the king's rashness. Saul felt a presentiment that his curses would return upon his own head. He returned to his home, moody and dissatisfied. Those most ready to excuse themselves in sin are often most severe in condemning others. Many, like Saul, when convinced that the Lord is not with them, refuse to see in themselves the cause of their trouble. They indulge in cruel judgment of others who are better than they. Often those who are seeking to exalt themselves are brought into positions where their true character is revealed. So it was in the case of Saul. Kingly honors were dearer to him than justice, mercy, or benevolence. Thus the people were led to see their error. They had exchanged the pious prophet, whose prayers had brought down blessings, for a king who had prayed for a curse upon them. Had not the men of Israel interposed, Jonathan, their deliverer, would have perished by the king's decree. With what misgivings must that people afterward have followed Saul's guidance! How bitter the thought that he had been placed upon the throne by their own act!